This is the Leadership Momentum Podcast with Chris Brown.
Well, hello, my friends. I hope you're having an incredible week. Many of you now have the fall festival behind you. And now we look to leveraging Thanksgiving to minister to those who, you know, may not get a Thanksgiving meal. And, you know, we're doing all this, you know, fall festivals and Thanksgiving, all while maintaining the day-to-day and planning Christmas. Ministry never ends, and that's a good thing, you know, it's a good thing. Ministry is such a privilege. We pour ourselves out, and in God's perfect way, we're ministered to in the process. And my most enjoyable seasons of my life have been the seasons where I was the most neck deep in ministry, and that's pretty cool stuff. Well, in this episode, we're in for a real treat. Today, we'll hear from the one and only John C. Maxwell. Last month, I sat down with John at an event that Dave Ramsey and we hosted right here in Nashville at the Hermitage Hotel. So you may hear in the conversation, maybe a bus going by or maybe a little bit of noise in the background, but that's just the hustle and bustle of Nashville. We were at the Hermitage Hotel, an absolutely stunning hotel, but that's kind of the location of our conversation. But we sat down with the sole purpose to casually discuss the topics of leadership and stewardship. And well, we recorded our informal chat, and here we are today, bringing it to your ears. And I pray that this conversation deposits some real value into your life. I know for me, immediately as we were talking, it deposited value into my life, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So without any further ado, here is my conversation with the legend, Pastor John C. Maxwell. All right, John, thank you so much for joining us here on the Leadership Momentum Podcast.
Great to be with you.
Obviously, you do a lot of writing. We've all been reading your books for a long time and speaking as well. You love to play golf. You're also around retirement age, approaching retirement age, right? So how do you spend your time? Like right now, how do you, between the writing and the speaking and the traveling and the media, give us a glimpse into your life right now?
Well, my life is very fulfilling and very full. They're fulfilling. It's full, all right. But it's very fulfilling in the fact that every day I write, that's a discipline I have. Every day I write. And so that keeps me always on the thinking side, kind of keeps me fresh. You know, every day I read so that I have something to say. You know, every day I ask questions. So my curiosity allows me to know what's happening. And I speak probably 120 times a year. I probably last year made 6 international trips.
Wow.
And everything's going well. I have a coaching company. Mm-hmm. Started 5 years ago. We have 16,000 coaches now in 143 countries in the world. Mm. We have the John Maxwell Company, of course, that continues to provide resources for people. And then we have Equip, which we've trained 6 million leaders in every nation of the world now, the only organization to ever train leaders in every nation. And then we started the John Maxwell Leadership Foundation, which is an organization, nonprofit also, Chris. We're writing high school curriculum right now for about 4 million kids. I think we'll get to 50 million by 2020, which is probably the most important thing I'm doing because it's, you know, that's the next generation. Yeah. And I'm really loving and committing that. In fact, I wrote a high school lesson today on forgiveness. What we do is we teach values. We put 16 values in a 32-week course. Kids have a course each week, and it's just very exciting what's happening. Last year in Ghana, we tested about 10,000 students, and we asked them going in how many of them wanted to be a leader, and 89% said they did not because they see the abuse of leadership mainly.
Yeah.
After taking the course, we asked them the questions again, how many of you want to be a leader? And I think it was 82% said they wanted to be a leader. So we literally turned that.
Wow.
Because they got to hear leadership. So that's very important to me right now. And I'm just loving my life. Have people ask me when I'm going to retire. I tell them I'm not going to retire. I really have no desire to.
Yeah.
You know, somebody told me the other day, retirement is doing what you want to do anytime you want to do it.
Yeah. And, so I said, and that's what you're doing, right?
I said, I'm retired. I'm retired. I had no idea because I'm doing exactly what I want to do, I'm doing it when I want to do it, and I'm just having a good life, and family's great, my health is good, and I'm 70, and loving every moment. I'm in the best days of my life and in the most fruitful times of my life, and nothing's winding down, you know.
Wow.
Somebody asked me why I was in such a hurry. I said, well, I don't have much time left. It's kind of like if I was your age, Chris, I'd play a little more golf, I suppose. But it's kind of like, wow, my window's closing, so I better get with it and do it as quick as I can.
That is so awesome. Literally, you point out my age, and it's like I feel so like I'm not doing enough because you were just like killing. I know you have a great team that you work
great
with.
Great people.
But man, it's so awesome what God is continuing to do through you. You had mentioned just a moment ago about the next generation and turn them from kind of the way they looked at leadership and then just boom to 82% shifted their focus, their perspective. Can you give us a glimpse into some of the things that you tell? Like, what is leadership? I talk to folks all the time, or I'll post something on social media that's not about leadership and it'll get a lot of engagement. I'll post something about leadership to a general audience, it won't get very much engagement. And I know they're kind of turned off to leadership. It's that same principle. What are you telling folks about leadership? Why is leadership so important, whether you're leading an organization or leading your family?
Well, first of all, I understand why people are turned off of leadership. Look what's happening, not only around the world, but in our own country. It's pathetic. I think that people are seeing what I would call very self-serving leaders. They're in for it for their political party or what's their agenda. And, the problem is, Chris, the people have been left out. That's a huge problem when a leader leaves out the people and puts himself or herself ahead of the people. And so, I tell people all the time, the first step of leadership is just intentionally adding value to people because that's what leaders do. They add value to people. And I was in Kiev a few years ago speaking to about 15,000 leaders and I was in the green room talking with my interpreter before we went out, and he talked to me about my book. He said, I've read your stuff, John. He said, you're going to have a problem here. And I said, what's the problem? He said, well, you talk so much about adding value to people, and when you walk out here to these people, they grew up in a communist country. And when you talk about adding value to people, they're not going to know what you're talking about. They've never known a leader that added value to the people. They've only known leaders that add value to themselves. And I remember walking out that evening and asking them, how many of you have ever been manipulated by a leader? Every hand goes up. How many of you have ever had personal abuse by a leader? Again, every hand goes up. And so I said, well, the first step of leadership is adding value to people. So let's start there. Let's begin to do the right thing. Because everything rises and falls on leadership. So if you got good leadership, it rises. But if you got bad leadership, it falls. So I try to help especially the millennials to understand that we're not talking about power. We're not talking about title, position. We're really just talking about making a difference in other people's lives and lifting them and adding value to them. And once I began to understand leadership in that context, it sounds okay. It's just that we don't have very many good models. And leadership's very visual. Mm-hmm. You see leadership. And so when you see bad leadership, it's very, just turns you off. You see good leadership, you go, wow, now I can get into that. So they just haven't had enough good leadership examples. And so with our high school curriculum, we teach leadership values. Because what we understand is this. If I can begin to live out good values, my life gets better. Mm-hmm. It just does.
Yeah.
I mean, if I begin to live out the golden rule and treat others as I would like to be treated, when I begin to live out honesty, when I begin to live out hard work, when I begin to do these, embrace and live out these values, I just get better. I don't get better because I'm even trying to get better. I just get better.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get better, what happens? Then I increase my value to other people. And all of a sudden, I begin to increase my influence with other people. And all of a sudden, people are starting to come to me and beginning to follow me. So what we're just trying to do with kids is, these high school kids, is basically this. I think you want to have the qualities of a leader even before you develop the skill sets of a leader.
Mm.
And I think most of the time we take somebody and we say, okay, we're going to develop your skill set as a leader, which is fine. But, I think they need to start on the qualities. I mean, once I become the right person, I can do some pretty amazing things. And so we just start with the values help them understand those values that will make them better. And that gives them influence with others, which then almost always positions them to lead others. And that's what we try to accomplish.
Well, speaking of values, kind of take us back to 20-year-old John Maxwell and obviously what God has done through you, through the actual avenue of leadership throughout the years has been remarkable. But all the way back in the beginning, is there someone that you saw with these values that you'd write about today? Or are they things that were inside of you, just the who you were? You didn't go after power, go after influence, or just who you were, and you kind of noticed them and wrote them down, either in yourself or in somebody else. But that 20-year-old Maxwell, speak to that 20-year-old now who's like, you know what, I want some power, I want some influence. What can we learn?
Well, first thing I tell people is that if I had one desire, Chris, you see, they see me all now. I wish they could have seen me when I was 20. They would be greatly encouraged. You know, just trust me, they really would. I tell parents all the time when they're kind of upset with their kids, shoot, I wish you could have seen me as a kid. You would kind of take a deep breath and say, it's going to be okay. Because I had nothing within myself, I think, that would have ever had anybody point to me and say, he's going to be a pretty good leader. I had an incredible visual model in my father, who still is alive. In fact, next month will be 96.
Wow.
He really modeled good leadership and good values to me. So I saw it growing up. So to say that's who I became, it's not because I was wonderful. It was because I was in an environment that was conducive for me to become that.
Okay.
Okay. And then I started pastoring. And in my first pastorate, I very quickly got discouraged, because I could sense that I was not a, quote, typical pastor. And it bothered me because I didn't think I was a good shepherd. Mm. I was a little restless, and, you know, I just really didn't care to kind of go out and burp the saints and make sure they were okay. And I wanted to go reach people and build a church.
Yeah.
My leadership was really coming out, but I would pull it back because I would look at the typical pastor and he was a shepherd. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I'm not a shepherd. And I finally came to the conclusion I was a rancher and that I never was going to be a shepherd. I was always fencing out, not fencing in.
Wow.
Then I read, of course, Oswald Sanders' book, Spiritual Leadership. And I read that at the age of 23. And everything changed. Once I biblically got the concept of what a spiritual leader really was, it just put passion in my heart to really become a good leader and to reach my leadership skills. And it was really great because I read the book, and of course I didn't know Oswald Sanders at all. And 20 years later, I was privileged to meet him. He's from New Zealand, and of course he's passed away now. But so I had him when I pastored in Skyline, San Diego. I had him come out and spend a day with myself and my staff. Mm-hmm. Just talk to us about spiritual leadership. And so he spent the whole day, and at the end of the day, I pulled out my book.
Uh-huh.
And I said, look at this. And of course, it was marked. There's nothing in that book that's not marked. And I thanked him. I said, I want you to know this book really marked my life and changed it. And then I had him sign it for me, and it was a real highlight. So, you know, Chris, as I look back at my early years, I was really fortunate to read some good books and be with some really good people that taught me a lot about how to expand my influence. I can remember my mentor, Les Parrott. He'd written 5 books, and he probably wrote more books than anybody that I knew in my little world. We were having lunch one day, and I looked at him, because I had no desire to write books. I'd never thought about writing, being an author. And I asked him, I said, you know, Dr. Parrott, why do you write books? And I'll never forget, he looked at me and he said, you know, I write books because I want to influence people beyond my own personal touch. He said, I'm very limited. If I've got to see somebody and talk to somebody, my world's very small. But if I write books, my world expands. And I can remember looking at him, and right then, I mean, I just leaned across that table and said, then I'm going to write books. And that's the day I started writing.
Yeah.
But I didn't write because I wanted to be an author or I had some kind of desire to have something published. I wanted to expand my influence. Little did I know that when I started writing books, what would happen to my world. And today, my writing world is huge. People that know me well think of me more of a speaker, but, 30 million books later, you know, I'm everywhere.
You write a book about every morning.
Yeah, well, I write every morning. I do. I write 5:30, usually from 5:30 to, if I have a good day, 5:30 to 11. I wrote today for 5 hours. But, yeah, I write every day. Now, some days, it may be only 15 minutes, so I want to be very careful.
Yeah.
Because some days my schedule doesn't allow me to have that kind of block of time.
Yeah.
But I write every day. The discipline of writing every day is a huge discipline, and that's where the compounding and the return happens. So when people ask me, you know, how did you write, you know, I don't know, 85 books or whatever it is. In fact, that lady, yeah, they said, John, she said, you've written more books than I've read, you know what I mean? But the key is every day.
Every day.
You know, every day. And I tell people all the time, find out what your strengths are, what your giftedness is. Mine's communication and creativity, which is writing, and leadership. Those are my three strongest gifts. And work those gifts every day. Because it's in your strengths that you get the compounding.
Yeah.
Not in your weaknesses. And so I have a phenomenal group of people around me, and they handle all the stuff that I'm not good at. So they really compliment me, they complete me, they make me better than I am. So I'm very blessed. I got all this incredible group of people that do all that, so I can just stay right in the sweet spot and you know, stay in the strengths. And I'm very grateful for that. I mean, you can't make it without a good team, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm sure you look back and you think that one realization that I'm not a shepherd, I'm a rancher,
yeah,
is huge as far as the trajectory of your life.
Yeah, it really was. And then what happened, Chris, was I thought, man, I'm not going to make it. I'm just not going to make it because I don't have it within me to tend the flock.
Right.
That's not who I am. And then I get this, oh, I'm not a shepherd, I'm a rancher idea. And then I read Spiritual Leadership. And those two thoughts just kind of gave me permission to branch out. And then the Charles Fuller Institute, this would be in the 80s, Chris, 1983, 84, 85, 86, they put on pastor conferences all over the country. And Rick Warren, Bill Hywels, and myself traveled the country doing these conferences. And we had a conference called Breaking the 200 Barrier, if you can imagine it.
Oh,
because the average church back then was about 110. And that's where I introduced the rancher concept. I said, you know, if you got a small church, you're probably a great shepherd. But if you're growing a church, it's probably because you like to ranch a little bit more. And we just started traveling all over the country, the three of us, doing conferences for pastors. And it was an awful lot of fun. And, you know, the three of us still every once in a while get together. It's just like, wow, you know, we're still at it.
That's great.
You know, that's, you know, just tell a bunch of old men stories that somebody like you don't want to hear.
Anyway. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. So let's talk a little bit about the communication gift that you have. Obviously, that's happening through writing, but also through speaking. Talk us through, like, prep for you. Like, I know it's probably easier now because your Rolodex, there's an old term, your Rolodex that is so thick.
You're going to have to explain that to all your your millennials right now saying, Rolodex, what the heck? You started to show a little age yourself there, buddy.
Whoops. So you've got all these files you can pull, these mental files. So I'm sure prep looks different now. So I don't want to discourage anybody who's new going into the pastorate. But what's prep look? I mean, you're speaking here. We're here now to give everybody some context on where we're at, the setting. We're here at the Hermitage Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. And you're speaking here at the Stewardship Summit. We've got about 40 pastors that are here representing 400,000 congregants. And you're speaking to them. So, I mean, let people know about your prep, what goes into it, maybe not for this event, but just how do you prep? And I know you got one big takeaway that you want everyone to take away, but how do you get there? Just walk us through your process. Get us in your mind a little bit when it comes to
spoken communication. That's a great question. First of all, let's go back to when I started preaching, communicating. I realized in the first 6 months of my teaching, preaching, speaking, that I had some good gifts there. People liked to hear me. And I was pretty quick on my feet and I could adapt pretty good and pick up stories and, you know, put some scripture with it. And I can remember about 6 months in asking myself a question. Nobody asked this question. I mean, all of a sudden I came to this realization that I could either wing it and just kind of live off of good charisma, or I could work at it. I could say, okay, I'm going to really work at communication. And I think when it comes to the area of giftedness, because in our giftedness, as you know, Chris, it's easy for us. Mm-hmm. If you're doing something that's easy, it's because it's a gift. If it's hard, it's not a gift. And so I knew I was already in my giftedness, and it was easy for me. And I thought, you know, man, I'll bet you I could spend an hour a week, get a scripture, get a couple of thoughts, get up there, smile at the people. And I think, man, this could be a good life. Or I could really make this gift of mine a fine work of art and do it for the glory of God and work hard. And I made a decision that six-month period that I was going to really work hard. And I filed every day, and I still do that practice. I have filed every day for all these years. I mean, I have thousands and thousands, and then let's talk about thousands of quotes, ideas. I mean, when my kids went to college, this is, of course, before the internet was that heavy, but you know, the whole process, when they were doing a subject, they'd just tell me, and I'd just send them, I'd say, here's some material. I think I had 1,400 subjects filed.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, I mean, I had, in fact, the joke used to be, if the house ever catches on fire, just go get the files. And so I filed every day. And so when it comes to communication, over the years, I've been doing this a long time, I'm building now this incredible communication filing system and this whole process. So, you know, I never run out. I never run out of material to write. I never run out of material to speak. Couple that with the fact that I depend very heavily on the God factor when I communicate. I think in our giftedness, if we're not careful, we can become independent. And what I realize is, you know, again, as a young communicator, that passage, without me, you can do nothing that Jesus said. I used to kind of go around with the Lord on that. I said, you know, I'm doing quite a few things that I wasn't trying to be nasty,
right?
But I'm doing quite a few things that
I'm good.
And I'm not praying. I mean, I said, oh God, you know, help me park my car. And then one day it hit me, just my time with the Lord, that what that passage meant was without me, you can do nothing of eternal value.
Mm.
And that what I was doing is a bunch of good wood, hay, and stubble stuff.
Wow.
But I wasn't doing anything that had eternal value. And that was the day I began to covet and become dependent on him. I said, okay, I want my stuff to last. I want it to be eternal. And so I, in my preparation, when I prepare, I work the teaching, I work the lesson, whatever it's going to be. And I get it down to where I think it should be. I've written everything out. I still write everything out. And then what I do is, usually about a day before I use it or communicate it, I let it work on me. I just turn it around. I've worked on it, done my best effort, and then I turn around, and when I say I let it work on me, I look at everything I'm going to say, and I keep asking myself one question: have I found that to be true in my life?
Mm.
And if I haven't found that to be true in my life, I scratch it. Because a long time ago I said, I'm only going to teach what I truly know and believe. Because that's where the passion comes in.
Yeah.
It's not, I'm not passing on someone else's thoughts and someone else's knowledge. I'm passing on what I personally know in my life. And so I let it work on me. And I can spend sometimes, you know, sometimes 3-4 hours just letting it work on me until I can look at that and say, okay, that's me. And the moment I have let that, now I'm ready to go communicate it, because now it's going to have conviction. It's because it's who I am, and it's how I've been changed, and it's what I believe, and it's what I know. And so I think communicators are great, more beyond what they say. They're great because they've had life change themselves. Life change is contagious. Words aren't, but life change is. And so, boy, once I communicate what I truly have had change my life, it's so contagious.
Wow.
And that's where I try to stay as a communicator. Mm-hmm. Again, it's who I am more than what I say.
Yeah.
But if it's who I am and what I say matches, then that's a powerful force for teaching.
So tomorrow you are, you know, I told everyone the context, and we're here at the Hermitage, and tomorrow you're speaking to a group of pastors, and the topic is stewardship. Just kind of give us a summary of what you plan to teach tomorrow, and I know that what you're going to teach is very beneficial to the team and the group of pastors that's here, but I know there's a lot of what you're going to share that's going to be beneficial to our listeners as well, so just maybe a brief overview.
Well, what I'm going to do, as a pastor, literally my first year in my first church, I went to that first church in Hillham, Indiana in July of 1969, and as the new year came, 1970, I thought I need to teach my congregation stewardship, management of their time, of their money, of their giftedness. And so I had my first stewardship month in February 1970, and it really worked well. I remember going up to Bedford, Indiana, to the Bedford Baptist Bible bookstore. That's too many B's. And looking for a stewardship book, you know, to help me. Yeah. And there was none. There was none. And I remember I was just so discouraged going back down to Hillham. I'm going to teach stewardship, and I don't have any books to read. Because back then, there weren't the resources we have now. And so I can still remember taking some of my favorite stewardship quotes and making signs of these stewardship thoughts, putting them around the church building, and then preaching on Sunday, going around each sign and reading it and exhorting off of it. And that started my stewardship teaching and preaching, of which for 25 years, I every year had a stewardship month. Mm. So when I'm with the pastors tomorrow, I go to just give them some stewardship principles that I try to live out and try to flesh out in my own congregation. Principles like we're to be a river, not a reservoir.
That's right.
You know, God only gives to us what he knows flows through us, so quit trying to hoard it. When you hoard it, you lose it. It's like the manna. Go out and try to get an extra day and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Just ain't going to make it. I think I'm going to teach them some principles, then we're going to do some Q&A. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure I'll teach them the stewardship principle of who owns my stuff. You know, I ask people all the time, you know, if you made $1,000 last week, how much of it is the Lord's? And you get these tithers, they'll say, well, you know, $100 is the Lord's. And I'll immediately know they understand tithing, they just don't understand stewardship. You know, if you made $1,000 last week, it's all his.
That's right.
You know, none of it's mine. Mm-hmm. And the moment that I understand it's not mine, everything changes about the way I handle all the stuff in my life.
Yeah.
Because if it's mine, I'm going to kind of conserve it and hold it and protect it and be selfish probably with it. I used to use this one illustration. This was powerful. I've done this and it's worked. I'd grab somebody before I would preach and I'd just give them a $100 bill. Uh-huh. And I'd say, now I'm going to preach this morning and there's going to be a time in my message. I'm just going to stop and say, my gosh, Margaret and I've got some friends just came in this service. We need to take them out to lunch afterwards and I don't have any money with me. Has anybody got $100? Can you just give me $100 to take them out to lunch? I said, now when I ask for the $100, just walk right up and don't say anything. Just hand me the $100 bill and go back to your seat. So I would do that, and I'd stop, and I'd do that. Man, I need $100, and you know where. So here come the plant, and they give me $100. I'd stick it in my pocket, and I'd just start preaching again. Of course, everybody, they're going crazy. They're going, the guy just walked up there and gave him $100. Didn't ask any questions. You know, why did he do that? And then, why didn't I do that? You know, they're not with me at all, and I know they're not with me, so I talk for maybe 30 seconds, go on like I'm going to leave them, and I stop, and I say, you're not listening to me. You're still trying to figure out why that guy so quickly gave me $100. And I said, I'm going to tell you something. I gave him that $100 before church service. In fact, I not only gave him the $100, I said there's going to be a time when I ask for it if you just come up and hand it back to me. I said, the reason that guy was so quick to come up and give me the $100 is it wasn't his $100. It was mine.
I'll preach.
He isn't sitting there fighting over that $100. It's all mine. He knows it's mine. And all he's doing is he's returning it. And I said, now just think about this. This is God. Mm. And man, when I'm messing around trying to figure out tithing and all this other stuff that people do when they don't understand, I said, I got to understand, it's not my stuff. And the reason he was so quick to give it to me is because it wasn't his $100. And the reason you were so slow in giving it to me is you still got that $100 in your wallet because you know it's not mine. If you think it's not God's, you're going to fight him all the time. But once you know it's God's, you're going to stop fighting.
So good.
So, you know, now all your listeners are going to do that $100 stuff next week. Hey, there are going to be thousands of churches, pastors going to get up there. Hey, I'll tell you a funny story. Every once in a while I do team teaching at Christ Fellowship down at West Palm. You know, and so that's our church, and, you know, half a dozen times a year teach for them. And so Tom wanted me to do this a couple years ago, wanted me to do a stewardship message, so I did, and I did a $100 plant. This is a true story. So I'm stopping. I said, I need $100, you know, and so Mike Plant, he gets right up there, And before my plant gets up there, a guy right on the front row gets up, reaches in his wallet, and he gives me $100. So now I got two guys giving me $100. One's a plant. The other guy, I just say, he comes out of nowhere, throwing $100. And I started laughing. And, of course, then I told him the story of that, you know, and here's this guy. And then I looked at the guy. I didn't even know who he was. And I said, you know, wow, you gave me $100. He just looked at me and said, I just love to give. And I thought if you need it, I'd be glad to do it. What's interesting is he was new to the church and wasn't even a Christ follower and just loved what happened that day. I think, in fact, he was Jewish and came back to church. And I think 3 or 4 weeks later, he gave his heart to the Lord.
But, oh, wow.
But anyway, that day, you know, it's kind of like, wow, I ought to ask this question more often. You know,
that's maybe, so funny.
But I never had another guy just come so quickly and kind of killed my illustration a little
bit. Right,
you know? But it was a fun deal.
That's a good engagement opportunity for our listeners. Hey, as you do the $100 exercise, you're going to do it. And we know you are. Tell us if another person comes up and gives you more money. I doubt that that's going to happen a whole lot of places, but I guess when you're John Maxwell, actually.
Well, only once. I've done that quite a few times. Only once did that really happen, Chris.
Oh, so that's funny.
I thought, boy, if I could get good at this, this could be a good thing for us all over.
So I reached out to Todd Mullins a couple hours ago and said, I'm meeting with John. Do you have any like dirty stories about him that you want to share and I can bring up? And I know you're nervous right now.
Oh, he's got
John Maxwell doesn't.
He has so many. Yes, anybody who knows me well has a whole bunch of them.
Yeah. Well, here's a story that went public that I just want to hear straight from you about. And I think about you often when I'm in the airport because you got busted at TSA for carrying a gun. From you. I want to hear it from you.
Well, what had happened? I had been over Chris Hodges' church, and I'd spoken for him. And the night before we got out to dinner, and he had a couple of his people with him. And they're asking me about traveling. I told him I was traveling, and one of them happened to be a gun dealer. He was over there, and he said, "Look," he said, "you're gone a lot." He said, "Your wife ought to have a gun," and so he said, "Here, take this, and it's a gift from me to her. You know, just have her get some practice." And so I thanked him, and I had my plane over there. So I got on the plane, and we took off. And my co-pilot really likes guns, and so he said, "What do you have?" So I showed it to him, and he had given me some ammo, and so he just loaded it and said, "Oh man, this is a great gun." And so the whole deal. And so I stuck it in my briefcase, went home, got there. The grandchildren were over at the house, and I thought, "Boy, I'll leave the gun in my briefcase, and you know, I don't want to take it out now." Forgot all about it. 3 days later, I went to the airport, not flying private, but flying public, and put that briefcase down there, and I literally, Chris, honest to God, you talk about timing. It is sliding under the screen when I remember the gun.
Oh, gosh.
And I jumped. I told the guy, I said, "There's a gun in there. There's a gun in there."
Oh, gosh.
And he's looking at it. He says, "Yes," he said, I see it. I see that gun." And, you know, within 2 minutes, I'm over in the corner. I've got two sheriff, one on each side of me. They're inspecting my bag. They're reading my rights. They're taking me down to a holding place in the airport, of which they interrogated me for 2 hours.
Oh my goodness!
And before they took me over to be fingerprinted and mugshot, and the whole process. And I still can remember the fear I had when I realized, oh my gosh, what have I done? And then I thought, all my life I've worked hard to have this place in life and ministry. And
yeah.
Now all of a sudden I'm taking a gun through an airport. And for the first hour of interrogation, they gave me no slack at all. They just kept asking questions, filling out forms. But about an hour in, the lead sheriff looked at me and he cracked a smile. And he said, "By the way," he said, "I do love your books." And I thought, oh, good.
You're going to be okay. Right.
And then I said, "Well, look, you get me out of this mess, and you know what I mean? I'll sign all my books I've ever written to you."
Right.
And give it. And they said, "Oh, now that's bribery. That's bribery." And I know. So, okay, well, let's back off of that. And of course, then I went over and they did the fingerprint and the mugshot. And everybody in that, I mean, half the people in that jail place knew who I was because that happened to be right where Christ Fellowship Church is. And so I came out on the other side, and Todd's dad, Tom, had an attorney already waiting for me. And his attorney says, "Don't let anybody know." I said, "It's already too late."
Right.
I said, "Trust me, it's out." Of course, it was the head of the 6 o'clock news, the whole deal.
Yeah.
But you know, a couple of lessons, quick ones that I learned out of that. One was it really didn't hurt me. I mean, you know, it went out quickly and got out quickly. We literally, as soon as I realized what had happened, we got so hit social media, and I said, look, here's what's happened to me. Mm-hmm. Let me explain to you my mistake. And I called it stupid hurts and talked about forgetting the whole deal. And so we got out real quick. In fact, my book agent, Celia Yates, my books just spiked like crazy. He said, John, he said, man, this was good. He said, do you think next week you could run naked through an airport? I mean, let me give you a couple of, this is really helping us out here. I said, no, I think this is more of a price I want to pay. But I did learn something beautiful through that time. And now I'm totally exonerated, and we had to go through a legal process. But I really learned that, you know what, if you just try to be the right person and do the right thing, and you got all these years behind you, outside of a few crackpots who want to just always shoot you down, most people, they just look and they say, oh, we know him. I think credibility compounds,
yeah,
either in a positive way or a negative way, as far as that's concerned. But to show you the power of fear, for 2 months I never got on another plane. I just flew private.
I'm sure.
And I remember I was in San Diego and I was getting ready to fly my first commercial flight. And before I left my hotel room, I looked in my briefcase to see if there was a gun. Now you have to understand, there's no gun. They took it away from me.
Right.
I don't have a gun.
Just making sure.
There's no gun. I get to the airport. Before I go through the line, I pull over in a corner. I open that briefcase, went through it all again. And there's no gun. And then when my briefcase went through the scanner and they said, oh, there's no gun, it's kind of like, oh, wow, okay, I made it. Shows you the power of fear.
Yeah.
You know, it just shows you how it really had a pretty heavy control over me at that time. But that's one of many, 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 many stupid things. You know, I wrote a book many years ago, 15, 18 years ago, called Failing Forward, How to Fail Correctly. Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought, well, I got all my failures in there, so I got that book behind me. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, I wrote a book called Sometimes You Win, Sometimes You Learn. And it was just a graduate course of other stupid things I've done since I wrote the first book. It's kind of like, man, I could, every 5, 8 years, I could do another book. I could do another failure book. It's just a gift. It's a gift. And so anyway.
Oh, it's so great. Well, I couldn't sit down with you and not bring that up.
Oh, I'm glad you did.
And hear it straight from you.
I'm glad you did. Wait till I see Todd.
Yeah. Well, John, we're so thankful for your heart for leadership, your heart for stewardship, and overall your heart for just adding value to people. And that's how we started the conversation, adding value. And you've added value to this audience today. So thanks for your time.
Well, thank you. And thanks for having me here. And of course, Dave Ramsey was just with us. We had a big simulcast in Atlanta about 10 days ago. He came down and did a great job speaking. And him and I just kind of trade off. You know?
Yeah.
We get on the phone. I know he's either asking me a favor to get up here or I'm asking him. And so it's kind of like, okay, I'll come up for you, but you do understand.
Right.
You got to come down for me. And we have done that for 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I just want you to know, and of course I tell Dave all the time, the value that he has added to people in helping get their financial act together. At this stage, billions of dollars that have been saved for the kingdom because of his incredible teaching on finances and how to get your household in order. So you talk about somebody's added value to me and to an awful lot of people, Dave Ramsey and what he does and what you guys do as a team here. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing. It really is. And so thank you for making a difference in the lives of people. You know, we're all just using our gifts and talents, trying to help people. And that's what we do, and we love it. So thanks for having me.
Well, as you can imagine, that was a special time for me, sitting down with John Maxwell. And after reading so many of his books and listening to him at so many conferences, it was just really cool. So, such an inspiring guy. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of the Leadership Momentum Podcast. I would like to ask you for a favor. If you have enjoyed this episode, if you know that your leadership will be improved as a result of listening to this episode, I want to ask you, would you share it? Would you send this episode to 3 or 4 people? Maybe share it with your team. Maybe share it through social media. I know there are many leaders out there that are desperately needing this content, and God can really use you to get it to their ears and get it to their hearts, which in turn will change whatever they are leading. So thank you so much for your teamwork on that. All right, next episode will drop on November 20th, and I will be sitting down with Dave Ramsey himself. Also coming up in upcoming episodes are Judah Smith, Levi Lusco, Daniel Fusco, and Roma Downey, and also my friend Daryl Strawberry, and many more. Literally, we've got some great conversations ahead of us. So stay tuned by subscribing on iTunes or Google Play. That is the number one way that you can show your support for this podcast. So thank you to all of you who have already done that. The number one way you can support this podcast is through subscribing on iTunes or on Google Play. If you'd like more information about stewardship and what that could look like at your church, feel free to email me at chrisbrownonair@stewardship.com. There's a powerful movement that's happening in the stewardship space in the last few years specifically, and we'd love to help you get in on it. Lives are being changed, marriages are being restored, families are being put back together as a result of people remembering the why behind the dollars and the cents that they get to, not have to, they get to manage. Again, all you got to do is just email me and we can go from there. ChrisBrownOnAir@stewardship.com. All right, folks, again, next episode drops November 20th. And until then, let's stay connected on social media at Chris Brown On Air. And let's continue to lead God's way and for God's glory.
Thanks for joining us for the Leadership Momentum Podcast with Chris Brown, brought to you by Ramsey Solutions. To learn more about Momentum, go to stewardshipcentral.org/solutions. Loved what you heard today and didn't want to miss another episode? Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. While you're there, share your feedback by leaving a review. Finally, stay up to date with Chris Brown, including his Life, Money, and Hope podcast, on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram by following @ChrisBrownOnAir. On behalf of your host, Chris Brown, and the team at Ramsey Solutions, thanks for joining us for the Leadership Momentum Podcast.